This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Queer Eye for the Straight Story, reading speculative fiction through a queer filter.
So this week was actually my idea. And I messaged Jules in the middle of the night. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning to ask whether we could do this episode because I just finished reading The Lies of Locke Lamora, which is book one in the Gentleman Bastard sequence. And I finished reading it. And for a majority of the book, I had been reading the main character, Locke Lamora, as a trans man. So he was transgendered. And that was the way I was reading it. And it got me thinking because I'm almost entirely certain that that was not the way that the character was conceived originally, or the way that Scott Lynch, the author, intended for Locke to be. But during my brief time doing English literature at university, before I went to straight creative writing, we did look at queer theory. And I did look at it beyond that as well, to be honest. And it's the idea of applying a literary lens with which you can critique a novel. And you see it all the time. For instance, people sort of analysing novels with a Marxist, you know, with a Marxist kind of view or a feminist view. You think about people sort of talking about Jane Austen being a feminist writer, but that was definitely not her intention during the day because feminism as a concept and as a philosophy didn't exist. But in the modern day, with our understanding, we are able to reanalyze these novels in the context of how they are being consumed by readers, and look at sort of how things are written. And one thing that is done is that we sort of look at the sexualities and genders of certain characters, and there are a lot of theories that go back with classic literature, and it usually is classic literature. So one we'll talk about a little bit later is actually that Sherlock Holmes was a transgender man as well. But I wanted to talk a little bit about Locke Lamora. So this is where this episode has come from.
Okay, great. I would, just before you get started, I want props for not disappearing down the Jane Austen feminist rabbit hole. because I could seriously get lost down there.
Don't worry, I will be there to help you navigate your way back. Anyway, we're talking about queer views. And yes. Just before, a little disclaimer is there are some people who don't particularly like the word queer. When we're talking about queer theory and things like that, those are the official names. Whether or not you how you feel about it personally, we don't mean it in any sort of offensive way. As a bisexual woman, I identify as queer, but this is separate, basically. Okay, so I'm going to start with Locke Lamora, and this is going to have a few spoilers for the books. Nothing too big. I don't really want to be revealing anything too big at all. So you're more than welcome to sort of listen in on this episode. I'm not going to ruin any of the story for you, just a few little bits and bobs, but none of the plot. So, having finished The Lies of Locke Lamora, I sat, and then at about sort of 12 o'clock at night, I sat down and I just wrote out an entire thought piece, an essay, which is on my website, all about how and why I was able to read Locke Lamora as a trans man. And it basically sort of comes into three things. And if any readers have read The Lies of Locke Lamora, please bear in mind that I am basing this entirely on the first book. I have had a few things spoiled for me for sequels, which may answer some of the things that I bring up here. But just based entirely on the first book, this is my reading. So there are three things that stuck out for me. And then there was kind of a fourth one that sort of came in as well. And the more I thought about it, the more I began to justify. But these are the things, and I'm just going to list them very quickly. And I'm sorry, Jules, because you haven't read it.
I have read it.
Oh, you have read it?
I have
you
read
have
it.
Read it.
I've read it such a long time ago, but I definitely didn't read it from the perspective you're reading it from. So that was really interesting.
Okay. All right. Great. So I can go into a little bit more detail here. Okay.
Yeah.
So these are the things. So I'm just going to give sort of the bullet points. So the first one is lock size. Lock is thinner and smaller than all of the other characters, aside from Bug, who's a 12-year-old child. Now, this is put down to malnutrition when he was younger. But he was adopted into Chain's care at around 6 or 7 years old, and he was relatively well fed from then on. But despite this, he's remained of a smaller stature than the rest of the characters, to the point that it's noticeable, and it's something that is repeated and brought up quite often, that he's very thin and that he's very small. Now, again, that's just one thing. But it does allow, it gives a small opening for the queer reading. So that's just number one, okay?
Yep.
Number two, Locke is not his real name. Very small spoiler, Locke is not the main character's real name. He named himself Locke, and we don't actually find out what his real name is. At the end, however, he does tell his birth name, rather, to his friend Jean. But as readers, we don't ever actually see what it is. And this in particular really kind of stirred my imagination quite a lot, because it was the idea of taking one's own name and rejecting one's birth name. And at the end, when Locke does tell Jean his name, Jean literally says, yeah, I can understand why you chose to go by Locke instead. You know, he says, if I were you, I would have chosen Locke instead. And you know, the joke is meant to be that it's not a very good name, but because we don't see it, and again, because of the other things that come into it, opens up the idea that the reason Locke rejected his birth name was because it was female.
Yeah.
So those are two little things that fit nicely within the reading, which sort of allow me to kind of to go along with it. Number three is that the whole premise of the book is that Locke and the gentleman bastards are con men, and they're very, very good at disguises. So Locke is actually a master of it. He's known as the best at mummery among the whole group. And not only is it with clothes, they have a lot of alchemy and potions and stuff like that that they use to change their appearances. Now, considering the fact that they have Tabitha in their ranks, who is a female character, it would be kind of strange if among all of the millions of costumes that they have that change your height and shape and things like that, they didn't have a binder.
Yeah.
So Locke Lamora would have had access to all of the materials he might want or need to battle dysphoria at any given time. And certainly, you know, to be able to present himself as his chosen gender.
Yeah.
So, and then number four, and I got all analytical on this in my thought piece. There are sources and everything. Okay. Number four is that Locke at no point, so far as I remember, ever refers to having facial hair or needing to shave. Okay. And I'm just going to read this out from my thought piece because I'm very pleased with it. So in fact, in chapter 12, part one, Locke notes of Jean that he hasn't shaven in several days, even though he's usually quite, punctual with shaving. He's usually very clean shaven. This suggests that they don't have a razor during this period of the book, which makes sense. Despite this, however, Locke only complains about the fact that he has greasy hair. He never talks about the fact that he needs to shave. Locke was unconscious before that, so it's very unlikely that Jean shaved him but didn't then shave himself. But we know that Locke is clean shaven because a day later, Even though Jean doesn't shave, Locke is wearing a false beard and a false mustache.
Yeah.
Which he does frequently. So this is a period of time where it's several days and Locke just doesn't have any facial growth at all. At least none that's noted. And once again, this could be a very simple explanation, which is just, oh, we didn't have time to see them shaving, or anything like that. But it really, really, really does, with all the other things combined, help, that queer reading. Now, there are three obstacles which could argue, which are the strongest arguments against Locke being a trans man, okay? The first one is that Locke is kicked in the groin at one point and is almost sick. The second is that he goes to a brothel and isn't able to perform. And the third is that at one point he is topless. And yet, all of these scenes, even though they could have been incredibly explicit in stating that he was a cisgendered man, don't actually ever do that. So, I'm sorry, this is just me rattling it off, but I'm very excited by this, so I hope I'm not boring you guys. So, first of all, Locke ends up in a bit of a scuffle, and he gets kicked in the groin. However, at no point in that area, it's just described as being kicked in the groin. At no point in the narration, and at no point Locke ever refers to the injury as being kicked in the balls or the testicles or any specific terminology at all. And actually, the line when they're describing the pain, the line when asked to describe the pain, Locke says is, "It's as though I'm with child and the little bastard is trying to cut his way out with an axe." So again, no terminology. And you could argue, yeah, but okay, but he almost vomited, and being kicked in the groin, if you don't have testicles, wouldn't make you almost vomit. I can actually tell you, yes, it can.
No, I was going to say, I would contest that. Anybody who's really been kneading the pubic bone, female who's been kneading the pubic bone, can tell you that while it won't necessarily drop you in the same way as a man, it is really, really bloody painful. It really will make you double over.
Yeah, it's very, very painful, whether you have testicles or not. But also the fact that Locke needs to vomit and the fact that he's very unsteady. He, as well as being kicked in the groin, he was also punched 3 times in the stomach and the solar plexus.
Yeah.
Which...
that'll do it.
which will absolutely do it, okay? So, second thing is him not being able to perform while he's at a brothel. Once again, never at any point is any terminology used. His companion, Felice, offers to get him an aphrodisiac, but it's never referred to the fact that he needs it to get an erection or anything like that. Locke simply says that this isn't working, okay? But again, nothing's explained. And there's no mention of a penis or testicles. Felice is described as rubbing Locke's inner thigh. And Locke says that he's nothing resembling aroused. He never uses language such as hard or stiff or any other words which are often ascribed to an erection in fiction. And the fact that Locke has a slender line of hair, which sort of goes down his stomach, is again not real evidence that he's a cisgendered man.
No, plenty of women have that.
Yeah, exactly.
I know people don't want to admit this, but you know, if in your natural, unshaved, unwaxed, unplucked state, there are lots of women who just, you know, that's normal.
Yeah. So, it really isn't, there isn't any evidence. And in fact, the fact that it sort of goes as far as to completely avoid anything like that sort of almost makes me, you know, say, yeah, that. We have no idea that he has a penis. We don't know. He very well may not. Finally, there's a scene where he's topless. Well, I think he's also topless when he's with his companion. But there's a scene where he's topless, and that's in front of Jean, who's Locke's closest friend, and Master Ibelius, who's a physicist, which is that world's equivalent of a doctor. Locke is topless because he's had the living daylights beaten out of him. And Ibelius needed to apply a poultice to his chest to help heal him. And this all occurs while Locke is unconscious. Now, the only problem I have with this reading is that it does kind of play uncomfortably into that trend of trans characters being outed through unconsensual nudity.
Yeah.
But again, it doesn't rule out the reading. And actually, more likely than Locke being outed at this point, Jean is probably already aware of Locke being a trans man. And seeing as they've lived together for so long and they're so close, this wouldn't be that shocking. And that would explain why there are no questions asked when Locke wakes up and why Locke isn't overly uncomfortable with being naked. Finally, the other thing is that there may not have even been need of a binder or anything like that. This is a world which contains alchemy, which is used to create a number of technologies, including heating and stoves and other things like that, other modern day conveniences. So it isn't beyond the realms of possibility that Locke, given the fact that they are pretty damn wealthy, wasn't able to purchase, you know, testosterone or a hormone equivalent, or even have had surgery during this time. It's all perfectly possible.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I realise that this probably wasn't Scott Lynch's intention, and that Locke is almost certainly written and conceived as a cisgendered man, but the book really does lend itself to the reading, and it is definitely worth considering the text with that kind of literary lens in mind, because it really does make you reanalyze certain amounts of Locke's behaviours, and the way he reacts to things, and the way that he acts in general. And as a trans character, I just find him very, very interesting. He's an interesting character anyway, but if you add that other element, there are a lot of things that kind of change a little bit. And I really enjoyed sort of reading the book like that.
I was just thinking that if it actually was Scott Lynch's intention and this was going to be his big reveal at the end of the series, that you've just screwed that up for him.
Well, he did say that apparently he is going to have a queer character in later books, and he said he's not going to pull a Dumbledore, so that is going to be explicit. So maybe it is, yeah, turn around, it's just actually Locke was trans this whole time, yeah. Which I would be totally down for, by the way. Just called it. Speaking of Scott Lynch, I wrote a tweet when I finished the book, which was something along the lines of Scott Lynch's The Gentleman Bastard sequence is just a series of tombs all about Locke Lamora French kissing the Grim Reaper whilst wearing various disguises. And he liked the tweet. So clearly he's still like, yeah, that's fairly accurate.
Yeah, seems it to me. Yeah, going back to what you were saying, I think this is really interesting because, and I sent you a very excited message earlier saying, I've got another idea for an episode. Yes. Which we won't go into, we'll do that another time.
Yeah.
But while I was looking, I was checking my facts, and there's obviously been lots of cases through history of women in disguise,
yeah,
which I won't go into too much. But one that's interesting to look at is that of Hannah Snell. She mm-hmm. was born in 1723 and died in 1792. And she enlisted in the army under the name James Gray. Originally, she did this to find her husband who'd gone missing. And it seems that she then got a taste for army life because she served first under General Guise's regiment under the Duke of Northumberland. Mm-hmm. And then she went on to join the Marines.
Sweet.
During that time, she was reprimanded several times and she was given corporal punishment where she was whipped shirtless. And nobody in that time noticed that she was a woman.
Does James have breasts? No, no. No, at all. So, I mean, so was...
It's worth bearing in mind the time frame, because obviously during that time women tended to be a bit smaller anyway, and mm-hmm. women's breast size has sort of gone up and down a bit over the centuries. She might just not have had very much there anyway, and then she starts working her shoulders and everything and building mm-hmm. up muscle there, and it might well have not been very noticeable.
Yeah,
but there are at least two occasions where she was tied to a whipping post and given the usual 10 stripes for insubordination, and they still didn't realise it was a woman. It wasn't until much, much later in her career that it came out, and she'd been serving in the army for a couple of decades by that point.
So did she still identify as a woman,
No, she identified as a woman. There is a difference. Going on to another point, somebody who was almost contemporary with her was a man named James Barry, who was allegedly born Margaret Ann Bulkley
mm.
in 1792 to 1795, who was a military surgeon in the British Army and died 25th of July 1865. Now, it seems pretty clear from the accounts there where people are genuinely not sure how to describe his gender that he probably was a trans man.
Mm.
And there are various other accounts. So I just thought it was interesting with your theories about Lachlan Moore. It's like, well, actually, it's really not out that outside the realms of possibility. There are so many cases of things like that actually happening in history.
Yeah.
And obviously, when I was doing research for I Hold the Tide, and I may stray into spoiler territory here if you haven't read it, so if you want to read it unspoiled, then tune out for a bit.
Mm.
But when I'll just be straight. When I was doing I Hold the Tide, I thought I was going to be writing about a female pirate. And this pirate absolutely insisted that he was male. Like, continually, this character insisted he was male.
Yeah.
But he'd been born Jennifer Tregowan.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me that I did a little bit more research and realised just how many women had actually joined gone to piracy, how many women had joined the Navy even, and they did it under male pseudonyms because it was illegal for women to sign the ship's register.
Yeah.
It's not outside the realms of possibility that there were quite a few trans men who actually, you know, went off and got the careers they wanted. I mean, if you think about it, moving away from their families and joining something like the Navy or going into piracy even, or joining the army would have given them the sort of freedom to be who they were that they desired.
Yes.
It might not have even been about a cause. It would have been a case of, this allows me to live as who I am, rather than who I'm expected to be because everybody knows me.
I think the main problem is that, and actually why queer theory is so important, is the idea that being trans is new.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's the genuine case of, if you dig into it even a little bit, you find all these accounts and things and fragments, and there's evidence that this is not the case at all. This is not a newfangled trend, as I've heard somebody refer to it.
Yes.
This has nothing to do with lax morals or the 20th century or whatever.
No, it really isn't. Which is why, actually, it's very important to reread classics with the view, with a sort of a queer theory and applying that queer lens. Because so often things in history have been rewritten with a very, very single and rather straight and cisgendered point of view. You know, to the point of the fact that whilst there were absolutely a lot of women who would disguise themselves as men for convenience, or things like that, there would have been many figures out there, both men and women, who would have been trans and who would have simply been dressing as their gender, not the gender for which they were assigned at birth. But because of the way that records have been taken and history has been sort of looked at, and it's not just with trans people, but, you know, with homosexuality and things like that, the way that records are taken, they say, oh, well, no, but this would have just been this, that, or the other, and try to explain it away. Which means that you get these characters and this total erasure of identity and a whole, you know, several thousand years worth of people who simply don't exist on paper because they were never recognized for what they actually were.
So, and then people say, well, they didn't exist in history, they're only existing now. This is clearly a modern problem.
Yes.
As if it's a problem even. And it's a case of, no, they weren't just invented. You know, gay people weren't just invented. We've probably had them. We've had gay people, we've had lesbians and people probably who are asexual as well, who, you know, since we were living in caves.
Exactly. So it's really, really important to recognise that reading books and reading classics with a queer sort of eye, as it were, is actually not just forcing your own views onto a book, but is actually analysing that time in a different way and looking at how the lives of someone who was trans or who was gay might have been in that time. And in the same way, you could no more argue that it's forcing views onto a book, then you could argue that the erasure of all of these people is forcing a view onto a book. All we can do is analyze history, and all we can do is analyze the text that we are given. And it is our right. And again, Roland Barthes is kind of grinning at me.
I knew he just slid in on his little
snail trail. He's just like, ha 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 ha. And I'm like, shut up, Roland Barthes. Go back to your grave. Roland Barthes is sort of very grinning, but he's right, actually, because we have a right to interpret texts as we will and the way that we process the information. And it just so happens that with the Lies of Loch Lomora, that was how I processed the information. And it wasn't because of any sort of trend or anything like that. It was because of the way that the character was written, which kind of made me immediately think there are certain things here which I would certainly use if I was writing a trans character.
Yeah.
That was kind of what set me off, was I suddenly went, hold on a second. There has never been at any point any, you know, moment which marks this is a cisgendered man. That's never proven for us. Never. And actually, sort of, the behaviours of Locke, the way he acts, sort of allows me to say, actually, I do believe that this is a trans male character. And it's really interesting in that way. And I think the reason, you know, a lot of people might push against me, there's two reasons. One is that it's a modern book. And they say, oh, but Scott Lynch is writing this in a time where he understands transgenderism transgenderism. I'm not sure that's even a word. Is that a word?
I don't know, to be honest.
Yeah, but he knows about these things. So if he intended them to be written that way, he would have called them that from the get-go, and not necessarily. So that would be the one argument, was no, if it was intended to be that way, he would have written it that way. And I say, I don't care. And the other one is the fact that they say, but it's not the right time in history, because this is set, first of all, it's not set at any point in history. It's a fantasy world. Second of all, I think that we are kind of clouded by the idea that we cannot have trans people. We sort of accept that, okay, we can have gay people back then. You're starting to see it now more in Game of Thrones. You have gay characters and stuff like that. So we're sort of like, yeah, I guess the gays lived back then, as they say. I don't know if anyone said that.
Never mind Achilles and Patroclus.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
Hercules and all his boys.
Yeah, all of them. They existed back then. But it's like, no. They couldn't have had transgender people back then. And actually, yes, they did. We have records of pharaohs and the like, who were transgender. So you can't deny their existence. But because they are were so limited in their representation within media and within historical fiction or historically set kind of fantasy, we don't tend to think or be able to process characters being trans unless it's explicitly stated. Whereas our automatic thing is to say, unless something is explicitly stated, they must be straight and cisgendered. And yeah. I encourage you all to stop taking that approach, because I'm going to talk about Jules's book now. Jules's book, where I know that she, with I Hold the Tide, several people read it, and several people did not see the twist coming at all.
No, it really sort of smacked me in the face at the end.
Yeah, and I did, sort of straight off the bat, I was just there like, well, obviously, because this character is transgender. And Jules is like, yes, that's right. You sort of, well, you didn't confirm it for me, but, you know.
I was like, Yeah. It's like, oh, bugger, I've made it really obvious. No, everyone's going to see it, but no, they didn't necessarily. No,
they didn't. But for me, it was really obvious, because I was not expecting it, but because when you gave those cues, I was able to analyze them, and I wasn't blown over by the fact that it was set in the past.
Yeah. I think that's probably the stumbling block some people had, because it was very noticeable that those people who are a bit more tuned into, I don't want to say queer culture, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Who have their sort of their finger a little bit more on that social pulse,
absolutely. Tended to get it quite quickly.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody got it quite as quickly as you did. But, generally, they were kind of like, yeah, that's that. And obviously, I confirmed it for nobody because I want them to read the entire book.
As if I wouldn't have.
But then there was this much, much greater swathe of people who got in contact and said, wow, that was such a twist at the end. That was amazing. But looking back, I can see you littered clues throughout the book. And I'm like, part of me was kind of like, that's brilliant, because I kind of want you to feel that way. And part of me was kind of like, it's almost a little bit sad that you didn't see it a bit sooner. And some of that is obviously you're into the story and perhaps you're not really thinking about unravelling the mystery. But some of it's a case of, some of it really does come down to the conformity issue, and it comes down to compulsory heterosexuality, cisgender norms.
Yeah.
And by compulsive, what I mean is that completely unconsciously, for the most part, society is set up as a checks and balance system of rewards and punishments, whereby if you fall into the normal category as it's defined, then you're rewarded. Whereas if you start to fall outside it, even if you fall outside it so much as being a girl who grows up and is more interested in football than makeup, you get punished for it.
Yeah.
And it's changing very slowly.
Yeah.
But if you're really outside the normal bracket, as in if you happen to at birth have the assigned gender of a girl, but you've always felt that you were male, then life has punished you for that all the way through.
Yeah.
And that same sort of conformity and the compulsive cis heterosexuality tends to mean that we all see things through a very, very non-queer filter all the time.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Which kind of really feeds into the erasure of a lot of people in history.
Yeah, definitely.
Not because it's malicious, but because of the construct which has been built around the way that we view things.
Yeah, it is social conditioning. I'm going to take a little sidestep there and talk about 19th century classics, and I'm going to read a small passage from Moby Dick.
Because yes!
I have a love-hate relationship with Moby Dick. It is a fantastic piece of writing. Herman Melville probably never wrote anything better than this. But I genuinely don't understand. Okay, I'll tell you what, I'll just read the passage and you can tell me how you feel about it.
Yeah, I think I know the passage you're going to read and this is going to be great.
It had cooled and crystallised to such a degree that when, with several others, I sat down before a large Constantine's bath of it, I found it strangely concreted into lumps, here and there rolling about in the liquid part. It was our business to squeeze these lumps back into fluid, a sweet and unctuous duty. No wonder that in old times this sperm was such a favourite cosmetic. Such a clearer, such a sweetener, such a softener, such a delicious mollifier. After having my hands in it for only a few minutes, my fingers felt like eels, and began, as it were, to serpentine and spiralise. As I sat there at my ease, cross-legged on the deck, after the bitter exertion at the windlass, under a blue tranquil sky, the ship under indolent sail and gliding so serenely along, as I bathed my hands among these soft, gentle globules of infiltrated tissues, woven almost within the hour, as they richly broke to my fingers and discharged all their opulence like fully ripe grapes in their wine, as I snuffed up that uncontaminated aroma, literally and truly like the smell of spring violets, I declare to you that for the time I lived as in a musky meadow, I forgot all about our horrible oath. In that inexpressible sperm, I washed my hands and my heart of it. I almost began to credit the old Paracelsian superstition that sperm is of rare virtue in allaying the heat of anger. While bathing in that bath, I felt divinely free from an ill will or petulance or malice of any sort whatsoever. Squeeze, squeeze, squeeze. All the morning long I squeezed that sperm till I myself almost melted into it. I squeezed that sperm till a strange sort of insanity came over me, and I found myself unwittingly squeezing my co-labourers' hands in it, mistaking their hands for the gentle globules. Such an abounding, affectionate, friendly, loving feeling did this avocation beget, that at last I was continually squeezing their hands and looking up into their eyes sentimentally, as much to say, "Oh, my dear fellow beings, why should we longer cherish any social acerbities, or know the slightest ill-humour or envy? Come, let us squeeze hands all round. Nay, let us all squeeze ourselves into each other. let us squeeze ourselves universally into the very milk and sperm of kindness. That's possibly the gayest thing I've ever read. In anything, not just 19th century literature.
It's incredibly homosexual. The imagery, the language, the everything is just...
Now, obviously what they're doing is they've caught a sperm whale, and the oil and fat in the whale's head, the spermatocete, mm-hmm. once it is extracted, it starts to congeal. Mm. And allegedly, they had to hand squeeze it back into a liquid form. But they've got their hands sort of up to their elbows in this gloopy white stuff, about the sort of consistency of PVA glue. And it's, you know, they're making the hands serpentine and spiralised. Their fingers are just slipping and sliding over everything. And then suddenly they're grabbing hands. And it's kind of like the pot throwing scene in Ghost.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're all feeling... Well, he certainly is feeling happy about it because he's getting all this contact with his fellow shipmates. To me, that reads as, okay, yes, I know they're doing a practical task, something that they'll get paid for because they're going to extract the oil and send it. But
yeah,
it is so unbelievably gay.
It is incredibly gay. And you really, really actually don't need to look at that through a queer lens, actually. It's almost expressly homosexual.
Well, the thing is, it is to us now, but that's not how it was received, is it?
No, but within the context of a modern readership, simply because absolutely. Of the way that language has changed.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, sperm there isn't literal sperm, because
yeah,
that would be quite something different.
Yes.
But this leads us on to, there's lots of these little things in Victorian literature, and sometimes I think a lot of it's unconscious. So moving on from that, I'm going to talk about Anne Shirley in Anne of Green Gables, who,
yes,
in my opinion, is bisexual. There's obviously 5 or 6 books in the series, and Anne eventually makes a traditional marriage with Gilbert Blythe.
Yeah.
But before that, she and Diane Barry have the most intense romantic friendship, and they use really intensely romantic language for each other.
Yes.
And then Diane Barry obviously goes off and marries somebody else as well. They both make traditional marriages. But it's really noticeable that Anne has her most intense in-love types of friendships and connections with women in those books.
Yeah.
I think she genuinely does love Gilbert when she marries him, and she certainly grows to love him, but she doesn't really fall in love with him in the same way she falls in love with her female friends.
Yeah.
So to me, she reads as bisexual, and I know this is really unpopular with the people who are really married to the idea of her being straight, but she reads as bisexual.
You know, I'm glad you say that, because actually that was something when I was young and sort of coming into sort of figuring out what my sexuality was, that I felt as well, that Anne had, and actually it sort of confused me, because I thought, if she's straight, but I feel this strongly about some of my friends, does that mean I'm straight? Is this normal?
I found that really confusing as well, in a sense of, but you know, we're supposed to feel this intensely about our friends, but not our future husbands, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the other problem is that we talk about the fact that there's certain language and things like that, and certain behaviours which meant something different for the audience that it was created for. But I also think that actually what happens is that sometimes the writers were being pretty explicitly gay and trans with the, I mean, for instance, the importance of being earnest.
Oh, yeah.
That it was just, Oscar Wilde was not dicking around. He was really, really not. I mean, it was the whole thing of that play. It was just a completely, it was full of innuendos.
Yeah,
and the importance of being earnest meant earnest was slang for being gay at the time.
Well, the whole Bunbury thing. So when I've had enough of time at home, I have a dear sick friend called Bunbury who I have to attend to. And it's like, that's slang for you going hanging out with your male friends at your club. I've always loved the expression, yes, I'm having to go and see Bunbury. I've always thought I needed a Bunbury of my own kind of thing, yes, to get out of family social engagements. But
I saw a post on Tumblr, which is, I don't actually know where it came from, but it's a quote from something. It says, in 1778, two Irish gentlewomen put on men's clothing and ran away together. Lady Eleanor Butler had received several offers of marriage, but was determined to share her life with her friend Sarah Pansby. They spent the rest of their lives in a black and white house called Plas Nude outside of Longellan, cultivating their garden, improving their minds, and filling the house with clocks, cabinets, and whirligigs of every shape and hue. They also had a little dog called Sappho. They're lesbians. They called their dog Sappho. I mean, how much more do you... For those who don't know, I mean, Sappho as a poet as well. For those who don't know about Sappho and the word sapphic and things like that, Sappho was a poet who was said to... She said that she was married, but her husband's name translates to man with big dick or something like that. It was, you know, like Bigus Dickus equivalent, yes, of ridiculousness. And all of her poetry is about loving women.
It's intensely sexual poetry as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's just the fact that you've got all these references of two women or two men living together and sort of refusing to marry, and it's like, oh, they were such close friends. I'm like, no, okay, that's not what happens. It's also the idea that a romantic relationship is different from a friendship. Like, you don't ever really like, you're not friends with your partner in life, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
like, it's a different thing entirely. And I genuinely do think that it's where shipping comes from, really. Because there's this whole kind of change of how we read romance and what sort of romance should be. And so when we see strong friendships now, we assign them as shipping. Or we say, yeah, oh, they're in love with each other, you know?
Oh, secretly, they can't even admit it to themselves.
Yes, yeah, so secretly that they stabbed each other, but really, it's love.
Sort of off the back of Anne Shirley, as it were. No innuendo intended there. There's obviously a really... There's the trend of the intense Victorian romantic female friendship, and that was kind of a thing, but I wonder how much of it was a thing because anything more sort of homosexual was frowned upon, and there wasn't much, you know, that unless you fell in with that community, you might not really understand.
Yeah, exactly.
And it, you know, it can be particularly, I think, if you're bisexual, you think, well, I'm attracted to men, so I can't be attracted to women as well. And a good example is Charlotte Bronte and Ellen Nussey. I'm not saying Charlotte Bronte was bi at all. I think Charlotte Bronte was actually kind of a flirt, but Ellen Nussey, if you read the letters Charlotte sent to her, so Charlotte was obviously replying to things that Ellen had said to her, and it makes for a really intriguing picture. Charlotte met Ellen at Cohen Bridge School when they were both children, and Cohen Bridge provides the inspiration for Lowood School in Jane Eyre.
Yeah.
So, but they formed quite an intense female friendship, to the point where Ellen Nussey wanted Charlotte to marry her brother, because if you can't marry the girl yourself, the next best thing is have your brother marry her so she'll always be with you. So it was kind of twisted and a bit codependent already on Ellen's side. But it reads as though Ellen was actually really in love with Charlotte. She was really upset when Charlotte did finally marry Arthur Bell Nichols, for example. But the things Charlotte wrote back to her, things like, oh, if only I were a man and you were a woman, and we should have a little house together to be kept by you, I would be as content as it is possible to be in this life. Things like that.
Yeah.
She was kind of, I think, personally, from reading the letters, I think Charlotte was well aware how Ellen felt about her and was kind of fluffing her the whole time, because Charlotte was not an attractive person by conventional standards, and she was well aware of it. She wanted to be prettier.
Yeah.
She hated the fact that she wasn't. She had a real thing for handsome young men. She definitely had her eye in for that. And I think it was kind of a bit of an I'm sure she loved Ellen as well, but I think it was a bit of an ego prop for her.
Yeah.
That she had somebody who desired her like that.
But, yeah.
So that's a bit sad and a bit twisted as well. But there was this really intense female friendship there that lasted their entire lives. I mean, I know Charlotte died at 39, but...
But yeah.
And then if you read things like Jane Austen's letters, there's no obvious sort of sexuality type element in there. But she talks very candidly to her niece and to her sister and various other things. The impression we're given is that people didn't know about things like homosexuality or, you know, genuinely sexuality and, you know, where babies came from if they were unmarried. And it's complete bollocks. They clearly did.
Yeah.
Jane Austen on several occasions gave slightly covert advice to friends and relatives that they ought to terminate a pregnancy.
Jesus.
Because they, you know, they spent a lot of the time pregnant. And if you've had six children, you're just, again, having another one. I mean, you can't have a baby a year your entire life.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not saying Jesus to her sort of advising them to have an abortion. I'm saying, you know, Jesus that this is, that we have this impression that Jane Austen knew nothing about these kinds of things, or that none of them really did. And of course, that's bollocks.
Yeah. Absolutely. And was obviously intelligent and open-minded, whether she personally approved or not. I think the impression you get from reading her letters is that she doesn't think her approval on personal matters is it's sort of none of her business kind of thing.
Yeah.
She was very vocal on politics and various other things. And you could actually get locked up in those days for writing something the government didn't like, whether you're a woman or not. I think that's the thing to remember. Obviously, if we haven't really talked about coding, but when you were talking about Oscar Wilde, obviously it was illegal to be gay.
Yeah.
And you would be imprisoned for it, as he was.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. Sometimes these things were covert deliberately because you could not talk about them, but writers still wanted there to be a voice.
But I remember arguing with someone about the fact that they didn't believe that Dorian Gray was at least bisexual. And I was there like, in what world?
Which version of the book did you read?
Where have you been?
It kind of reads like he sleeps with women because he's got bored of sleeping with men. I mean...
Yeah. So far as I read, it's just Dorian Gray will sleep with anything that has a pulse or not. To be honest. Pulse optional.
Pulse optional. Well, speaking of pulse optional, you go on to Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yes. Now that'd be gay.
That's really gay. There's obviously, you know, Jonathan and the two daughters and the mother, the vampires.
Yeah.
But there's a strange sort of intensity between, you know, the Count and Jonathan Harker himself.
Well, he specifically says he's mine. And we never actually know that Dracula plans to kill Jonathan Harker. He might very well have wanted to change him.
It was the fact that he deliberately keeps him alive but weak. I mean, he doesn't need him anymore once he's moved to Carfax Abbey in London, does he? Jonathan Harker's left behind with the vampiresses. So the fact that he's left him behind and hasn't killed him, he could just be playing with his food, but it also, to me, strikes a bit sort of like, I've got plans for you, my lad.
Yeah.
In the future. And then you've got Mina and Lucy, who on the outside would appear to be having the most typical Victorian romantic friendship ever. And yet, and it comes out in the Francis Ford Coppola version in the film, where, you know, they're kissing in the rain, and I'm like, they're slightly in love with each other.
Yeah.
Is anyone else seeing this? This isn't just two girls who like are closer than sisters kind of thing. They're slightly in love with each other. They're both going to marry other people, but...
This is the other thing, right? This is during a time where we had the sudden notion of chivalry sort of came back as well.
Yeah.
And the Arthurian legends became very, very popular. And there was the whole sort of knightly love, courtly love, really came into vogue again, which is the idea of love, which was totally pure, and would never lead to anything. And I think that in some ways, a kind of a lot of sort of relationships between female characters were, and male, two male characters were kind of put like that, is that this was such an intense love. It was a great, this love which went beyond brotherly love, but it was pure because there wasn't a sexual element to it, but it was love but it was never identified as the kind of love that one has when one's married, because actually during those times, marrying for love wasn't really a thing.
No, so you wouldn't necessarily make that connection.
Yes. So sort of friendship and things like that. I wanted to talk about another piece of modern fiction with which I have read and adamantly continue to read the characters as non-straight. And that is The Cursed Child, the Harry Potter sequel.
Yeah, I still haven't read it because I couldn't get over a bit that happens in the beginning. I will pull myself together. But from the bit I've read, I was kind of like, yeah, I'm kind of reading you as gay.
Yeah. Scorpius, I am 100% sure, is gay or bisexual. Okay? But Scorpius definitely seems to have an interest in Rose. But the relationship between Albus and Scorpius, and the intensity of their relationship. I know it's kind of meant to sort of parallel the friendship between Ron and Harry when they were younger, but the way that they're written, it just makes sense for them to be in love with each other but not realize it yet. Also considering the kind of the bad, the sort of the reputation that they have when they're together, that they're kind of being pulled apart. There's a whole kind of sub thing going on. And the sort of the romance that they have with other characters feels nothing as genuine as the relationship that the two of them have with each other. So I just, and when I saw the performance, you know, that Albus hugs Scorpius a couple of times, and Scorpius is like, oh, do we hug now? And I almost felt like he was going, oh my god, I'm being touched. I'm not used to this. I kind of like it, but I don't. I'm just sort of people being awkward with their crushes, as it were.
Yeah.
And people get mad when they see that, because first of all, people say, oh, why are you sexualizing these kids? I'm like, I'm not. I'm not sexualizing these kids. But they're teenagers, you know, at this point. And when you're queer, you're always queer. It doesn't just happen suddenly. Even if you don't know it at the time, you're always queer. It's like, oh, you're sexualizing kids. Are you kidding? Two people put toddlers together and they're like, oh, they're going to be girlfriend and boyfriend. You know, straight people are crazy. So,
yeah.
So I'm not sexualizing these kids. I'm saying that I think that they have crushes on each other. And I'm no more sexualizing them by saying that than you are by creating these weird love interests that they have with other characters. So there's that, first of all. And second of all, people get kind of annoyed because they're like, oh, why, you know, why do you have to make everything gay? Why are you shipping them like that? And this is my challenge to all of our listeners, right? From now on, the next book you read, what you're going to do is you're going to assume that all of the characters are queer. All of the characters are queer until there's proof that they're not. Okay? So you can say this character's gay. Oh, no, wait, he's kissing a woman. I guess that means he could be bi, but he's not really enjoying it, so maybe he's just kissing the woman. Okay, that's what you're going to do. You're going to change the way in which you process information. And you are going to just swing it around and say, actually, what is it? Why do we look at being straight and cisgendered as the norm? And what does that mean that we kind of miss otherwise? And I guarantee you that from that point on, once you've really kind of started to analyze characters and text and no longer think of straight and cisgendered and male really as the norm, you will start to notice things which will allow you to kind of reanalyze characters. And it was that really that meant that the moment I read I Hold the Tide, I knew the character was trans straight off the bat, because as far as I was concerned, it was obvious. It was brilliantly written. You know, I'm not saying that you're an obvious writer, Julie. but I knew what to look for, because I knew what to see. It wasn't a twist for me. It was just a very, very pleasant and great book that I got to read and sort of see how you were going to sort of present all of the information and how it was going to come out. But I felt kind of actually sort of comfortable, because I almost felt like the character didn't need to come out to me. Like, I just knew who they were, and I had a connection with that character. So that's my challenge for the week for all of our listeners. Read it gay. Read it queer.
We haven't really talked about asexuality. I'm just going to briefly mention The Woman in White and the fact that I've always, even without realising it, read Marianne, mm-hmm. one of the two sisters in that, as asexual.
Yes. Okay.
And she is probably the best written of Wilkie Collins' female characters, because the man could not write female characters for shit. But Marianne's really interesting, and she has agency and she's dynamic. And Count Fosco says of her, "Had I such a woman at my side, I would snap my fingers at the world." Count Fosco's the bad guy.
Yeah.
The real brains of the operation. But he recognises how dangerous Marianne is, because she thinks. And now, I think Wilkie Collins was kind of going for, well, she's a bit mannish and ugly and intelligent, so she knows she's not going to marry. But to me, she reads as somebody who's interested in people, has intense friendships, just doesn't really feel any sexual desire.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you can write an asexual character without necessarily meaning to, which was something I did with I Belong to the Earth, with Helen, who had quite an intense sort of love-hate romantic feeling for Kate, but wasn't interested in sexuality at all.
Yeah.
So,
which is also probably why she wasn't pulled in by any of the other antics.
Yes. So I think it's interesting, because these things you notice in life and you think you're just adding them to a character, sometimes what they mean is something different than what you think you're saying.
Yeah.
And it might be that you're noticing things in life and then putting it down to something else, and actually what you're noticing is something that's perfectly normal but you just haven't considered.
Yes.
If that's not going around the houses too much.
No, I think you're completely right. And I think actually also the moment you start to, you recognise how your own experiences affect the way that you read something, you can also open up yourself to reading books in another way, which sounds like it's a lot of work, but actually, truthfully, it will create a whole new world for you.
Yeah, definitely.
And you really can read a novel several times over and get something different out of it every time. So look deep and recognise. I recognise that actually a part of the reason that I am capable of sort of reading into a lot of sort of the queer theory and a queer lens is the fact that I'm part of that community. And feminism as well is that I'm a feminist. So these things are obvious, that they're obvious to me. I see them automatically. But that doesn't mean that I can't read a text in a Marxist way, even though I'm not a Marxist.
No, and I think that, as you're saying, that's the important thing, is that the free your mind enough to read it from different perspectives thing. Don't be so hidebound by one particular set of conditions that you can't see anything else.
Yeah. And I think we're out of time. This has actually been a really interesting... Sorry, I see that like our other discussions aren't interesting, but I've been really looking forward to this, and I really enjoyed that. So... thank you.
No, thank you. It was really interesting. Obviously, we are interesting.
Of course. Before we go, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, it's Jules.
Jules? Yes, I have just finished reading an anthology called All Out. And the subtitle is Stories of Queer Teens Throughout History. And it's a collection of 17 stories featuring queer protagonists. set in various different parts of the world, although mostly the US, it has to be admitted. And it's absolutely brilliant. You have trans characters, gay characters, asexual characters, and it's not just a book about coming out, it's a book about identity, really. And the fact that it's set through different periods of history is brilliant, because obviously, as we were saying, you know, they weren't just invented. So it's kind of taking back a little piece of that voice that was taken away by history being varnished over.
Yeah.
To, you know, disinclude them on purpose. So I highly recommend that. It's well worth reading.
Okay. Thank you for that recommendation. And on that note, we'll catch you guys next week. Thanks for listening and bye-bye.
Thanks and goodbye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.